At a time when women weren't allowed to attend the military academy, one woman refused to let that stop her. Her determination led her to become the commander of 69,000. It also made her the first American woman to be named a four-star general. Anne Dunwoody's new book is A Higher Standard: Leadership Strategies from America's First Female Four-Star General. She's now retired from the military, a sought-after public speaker, and it is a great pleasure to welcome General Anne Dunwoody to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Joe. It is great to be here.
Very nice to have you with us. How hard was retirement for you?
You know, after 38 years, and especially the last, almost my entire time as a general officer at an Army at War, I was ready. It was time, and you kind of know it's time, and I loved every minute of my service with the Army and my comrades, but it was time to spend some time with my grandkids and my 96-year-old dad and things that I had let slide because of duty.
You talk about your dad. Your father, your grandfather, they were in the military. There are actually four generations of West Pointers in your family.
That's correct. Long gray line.
So how does that influence your decision to become a part of the Army?
Well, Joe, quite frankly, I was probably one of the few in the family that really never thought about coming into the military at all. I was a tomboy, if they still use that word or not. I love sports and athletics, and I spent most of my life to include selecting one of the best physical education colleges in the country, Cortland State in New York, to prepare myself to be a teacher and a coach, which was my lifelong dream.
And then what happened?
and then my junior year in college, and this is right after the end of the Vietnam War, and that was not the best time for our Army. The Army's trying to recruit women. And if you were accepted into the special program, they were going to pay you $500 a month during your senior year in college with a two-year commitment to the Army and a commission as a second lieutenant. That was a hard decision for me, even with all my military background and family, because I was so set on being a coach. But that was a lot of money back then. And I thought, I'll do this, and it'll just be a little two-year detour en route to my becoming a coach and a teacher.
And were you surprised by how you enjoyed it and how 2 years led to 5 years led to 10 years, dot, dot, dot?
You know, it was. I still remember telling my dad, you know, my first assignment was Fort Sill, Oklahoma, out in the middle of the country, not close to much. But I found I loved leading soldiers. I loved being a soldier. And I remember telling my dad, you know, I'm going to keep doing this as long as I enjoy it, love it, and I can make a difference.
This may seem like a stupid question, but let me try it anyway, which is, do you think you have to be a good soldier and understand what that means to be a good leader of soldiers?
No, that's not a stupid question. That's a really good question. And I think leaders also have to be good followers. And I think at the end of the day, you know, and I talk about coming out of a values-based family and going into a values-based institution, our military, you know, where you take an oath and you're held to a higher standard through uniform code of military justice and you have standards for everything you do, that being able to meet those standards, just like the soldiers, being able to expect yourself to be able to do exactly what they do before you ask them to do it, is all part of being a good leader.
One of the things I found fascinating in the book is it was always sort of touch and go with you. You went through the 2 years, and then there was a decision to make. You went through your next round, and there was a decision to make. It was always you were looking to see if this was something that, A, you were still enjoying, and you felt that you were making a difference.
Yeah, and I think that was, I mean, I didn't realize at the time, but I think it was also part of my strength of conviction to the military. Because at any time, I always had that coach and teacher in the back of my mind that I could get out and go do that. But every time the Army would offer me this assignment, which seemed exciting, and it seemed like something that I could make a difference, and I truly did love the camaraderie and the teamwork and the responsibilities, that it really was one job at a time for me.
You point out in the book that there was always a concern about who would continue to fight for the soldiers when you left them. And what do you feel you were fighting for? What were you, on their behalf, what were you fighting for?
You know, I think along the journey, there's always something, and probably in every profession, and yours included, that when you believe something, and one of the examples I give in the book is just fighting for the latest technology for logisticians so that we could track and account for all of our equipment. We were using spreadsheets and old antiquated means to try and account for a property in our Army when we were an Army in motion, deploying all the time, units rotating, equipment moving here and there. And so we really needed the latest technology so that we could manage our equipment in a very prudent way for the take care of the taxpayers' money. But the tendency is to focus on, you know, bullets and better equipment. And so my fight and plight for that was, I remember the Iron Mountains, you remember from Desert Storm, the containers
right.
stacked up. We didn't know what was in them. We didn't know where they're supposed to go. And we sent 20,000 of them back unaccounted for. And so to fight to get a system that would get us out of the dark ages, to bring us into the 21st century of technology, just like the combat arms, there's real-time intel, real-time operational maps, and real-time. We didn't have that in the CSS, the Combat Service Support Logistic World, and that I thought we had to do and had to fight for. And thank God, with the help of a lot of people, we were able to do that.
I find it really interesting in reading the book about how this the landscape changed for you. As you point out, the U.S. has now been involved in active combat for more than 13 years. That's the longest protracted period in modern history. You joined the Army. It's the Soviet Union, North Korea, China, and Vietnam as the hot-button issues. And by the 1990s, we're at war in the Middle East, and Iraq has invaded Kuwait, and you have the Persian Gulf, the Red Sea, Iraq, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia. It is a completely different landscape.
Absolutely, in a different kind of warfare. And we had to transform to keep pace with the old linear Soviet battle, you know, tanks up front, you know, and the support folks in the rear. And now we're in this asymmetrical world where no one is safe. Everyone is at risk, whether you're driving a vehicle with supplies on the convoy, with IEDs, ambushes. It's a very, very dangerous world, and it's not in any one particular country, but it's now global.
So when it comes to and you point out in the book, everything changed after 9/11, right? I mean, your job drastically changed after 9/11.
Absolutely.
How did it change you as a leader?
I think you had to adapt to this new world, and as a logistician, to be able to, when you think about, and I'll use Afghanistan as an example, here's a landlocked country about the size of Texas with only less than 2% of its roads are paved, with 18,000-foot mountains and forward operating bases that are 100 miles apart. And now, as a logistician, instead of just pushing supplies and, you know, behind following the soldiers in the formations and resupplying, now you're trying to figure out how to get equipment, supplies, food, beans, bullets on. And now we're dropping by air. We're using mules. We're using sea lift. We're using airlift. And we're trying to synchronize all of this logistics so that the warfighters and the men and women in harm's way now in the front are have the means to stay focused on the fight. And that it was challenging, but it was exciting.
General Ann Dunwoody is our guest. The name of the book, A Higher Standard: Leadership Strategies from America's First Female Four-Star General. As you point out, that prior to 9/11, the policy on women in combat was pretty clear. Women were not allowed to be assigned to units where their primary duties would subject them to direct ground combat action. You do say that that changed after 9/11, but it wasn't a drastic change, was it?
Not really. It was actually the change in the modifications to the policy was to keep pace with the warfare. And before, you're right, women could not be assigned to units whose primary responsibility was direct combat action. But when the battlefield changed, instead of assigning, we could be attached women because we had to. We needed medics in places where you needed medics and you need fuel handlers. And regardless of gender, you needed these capabilities to be in different locations on the battlefield than the original policy was designed to accommodate, because warfare had changed. And now, as you see, the current policy to open up combat arms is also changing to accommodate a new world order.
You just used the word attached, and in the book, when you use it in quotes. What does that mean, attached?
It's kind of on loan, I would say. So you're not assigning these medics or to the unit, which was the policy, but you're loaning them is how I would best describe that for the American public.
So let me read a paragraph from the book, which is you saying there are many arguments made for and against women being permitted to train and perform in direct ground combat roles. For me, there is one primary question. Can a woman meet the same standard required of her male counterparts? If she can, then there is no reason why women shouldn't be able to do the job. The underlying question is whether the standards have evolved in a way that wrongly discourages otherwise qualified applicants from completing the training regimen. What do we do about that?
The policy to remove the restrictions also came with an opportunity for our command and our service chiefs and the combatant commanders to review the standards required for all the specialties now, and determine what those standards actually are to complete, whether it's Ranger School or SEALs or fill in the blank, any infantry, and identify what those standards. And we've had some standards that were historically based, some that was just because it's always been that way. And now the service have a chance to review exactly what is required for that MOS. What do you have to do? How many pounds do you have to carry? How far do you have to walk? What do you have to do to become a Ranger? And the once they identify those standards, then that's the standard for that mission. And regardless of male or female, if you meet that standard that's been identified for that mission, I personally believe they should be allowed to compete. Now, the key in my book very emphatically is that we can't lower the standards to accommodate people that aren't capable of doing it.
You also say that there is this, you know, one of the drivers for opening more combat roles for women is the perception that women can ascend to the highest levels of the military without the opportunity to command in combat. So you go to this retired four-star conference last year. One of the attendees goes on this rant about women in combat. He argues that the military and the army are making a big mistake by opening more combat roles to women. And he comments that every time we open another door for women, we lower the standards. So immediately, all the eyes go to you. All eyes go to Anne, the woman in the room. So first of all, I have two questions. One is, do you feel pressure on that you become really the spokesperson for the gender?
I think I felt not the pressure, but the responsibility to speak on the issue. And people, you know, just because folks change policy, that doesn't mean you can change biases or prejudices that exist in people's mind. And only by, and I make a point in the book, only by demonstrating that you're capable, that you can exceed the standard, that you can gain the respect and credibility. And I do believe that all the good leaders that I served with always lived to a higher standard. But back to your question, yeah, I felt the need to explain what happened to me. If they had not let me go into airborne school way back in 1976 when they were just opening the doors for women to jump out of airplanes and be a paratrooper, it wasn't a popular decision. It wasn't greeted with open arms. But you go, you do it, and you don't let people deter you from something you're passionate about, something you can believe in, or they win. Now, if I hadn't been able to go to airborne school, if I hadn't completed, my journey would have been much different. I would never been in the 82nd Airborne Division. I would never been able to command there. I probably wouldn't be sitting at that four-star. table.
Right.
That opportunity led to more opportunities. I never wanted to be a ranger. I didn't want to be a combat arms. But if there are women who believe they can and have the desire and the passion and can meet that standard, I believe they should be given the opportunity. And that was my point to the four-star title.
And you always believed that you could. You knew that you were more than capable of meeting the same standards as the men, both physically and mentally.
Yes, I did, and I did. You know, I was a phys ed major, and this is a very physically demanding profession, and I loved doing that stuff. I loved running. I loved doing push-ups. I loved jumping out of airplanes, and so for me, it was not a challenge to exceed the standard. It was just my own personal goal.
You look at your career and what you were able to accomplish. Was being a four-star general or a general even on your radar?
Oh, it never was. I never set out to be a general. I set out to go in for 2 years and then get back out and get back into my teaching profession. And what I found was that my passion of teaching and coaching just happened to end up taking place in a different profession. That's the Army. Coaching and teaching on the battlefield and classrooms and in a profession where you have a huge family, where you're always coaching and teaching in a very physically demanding profession. But becoming a four-star general, I was fortunate. I was blessed, humbled, and honored. It just was not on my radar screen that it was a desire or an insight for me.
What do you think you accomplished as a leader?
I hope the most important thing that I accomplished was building a bench of leaders behind me, because I think in any profession, the most important thing we do is not how many jumps we have out of airplane or how many tons of supplies we push, but the leaders that we develop for the future that are on that bench, so that when you walk out that door, you're confident there's a next group of leaders that's going to continue on the journey and take this organization to a new level.
You do make the point, and I thought it was interesting, because it's a somewhat obvious point, but it's a good point, which is you were always one to say, okay, well, look, if I take the moral high ground, it's easier to have confidence if you're right.
Absolutely. You know, I guess you talk about different kinds of leaders, and it's easy to maybe get derailed by, as I call, people that are patronizers or people that don't like you. But I tell people, stay on the moral high ground, be professional, be fair, don't stoop to low tactics like name-calling or innuendos, just stay. And you will convert people. They will see that, you know, you are a professional, you do exceed the standards. And in the military, people want the best athlete on their team. They want the fastest runner and the best shooter. You know, you're not ruining the curve. This is a dangerous business. And at the end of the day, good leaders will take the best athletes.
How much diversity did you see in the Army?
Well, starting out very little, because it pretty much that's just the Army of the 1975s, and we still had the Women's Army Corps when I came in. And so the beginning of the integration, which was shortly after I joined the Army, late 70s, of women into the Army, I watched for almost four decades the doors continue to open and women coming into and rising to higher ranks and greater jobs, commanding battalions, commanding brigades, and becoming one-star generals. So it's been a journey and it's evolution. Nothing happens overnight. But what you see and what I saw was the importance of diversity, and recognize that if you could leverage the power, and it's not about numbers, which people can get hung up. It's not one of these and one of those. It's the power of the diversity of thought. And people bring different perspectives from all walks of life. In today's environment, there's really tough questions out there, and there's very complex questions. And I don't have all the answers, but I knew if I had a team, a diverse team, that would bring me perspectives or solutions from different views, different lenses, if you will, that had come up with a better answer.
When you think about being the first, female four-star generals, how many are there now?
There's two in the Air Force and one in the Navy, and I'm sure more in the making.
And is that what is encouraging to you, that you're optimistic about, that there are more in the making?
Yes, I am. I hope, and I hope this book reinforces that, because I hope the book, at the end of the day, inspires people to dream big and find ways to make a difference in all walks of life, but in my business, the military.
Well, the name of the book is A Higher Standard, Leadership Strategies from America's First Female Four-Star General. General Ann Dunwoody, I thank you so much for being with us and for sharing your story with us. What a great pleasure and honor to speak with you.
Thank you, Joe. It's been a real treat for me, too.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book is A Higher Standard by General Ann Dunwoody. The book is published by DeCapo. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.